Blog Talk Radio.
Is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At the World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that astounding future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing great. Doing real good. Got an interesting show tonight.
Well, you know, once in a very great while, we do something kind of topical, right? I mean, we
yeah.
Rarely is it said that the discussion on World Transformed is lifted from today's headlines, because usually we're trying to lift them from 10 years from now's headlines, or, you know, 100 years from now's headlines. But the unbelievably tragic events in Germany of the last couple of days, just so closely tied to one of our topics from last week, and a topic that we revisit all the time, which is that of self-driving cars. In this case, I'm going to talk more generally about autonomous transportation. But I just thought we should, you know, let's spend some time talking about that this evening. You know, it's a terrible tragedy that's occurred. It's fresh in everyone's mind, and not just tragedy. It's apparently a horrible crime that's been committed, an atrocity, really, I guess is the only word you can use to describe it. And we want to look at it from the standpoint of, you know, where are we going in terms of humans in the loop? That's the name of the show. Where are we going in terms of doing something about the ability that people have to cause, not necessarily this kind of problem, but to cause problems where getting people from point A to point B is concerned? This is the most extreme example, obviously, that you can think of the kind of damage that a person can do. An aircraft going at 430 miles an hour, and when someone has sole control of that, and, you know, I don't know if you call it evil intent or insane, or, you know, what's going on in the mind of the person doing it, but that level of destruction goes well beyond what we normally think of when we talk about the kind of harm that someone driving in an automobile can do. But that's where we were last week, and I thought it would be interesting to start back there, because you had made a really interesting point, Stephen. I thought we could just revisit that real quick. You had made a really interesting point about the risks, the downsides of self-driving cars. We're all about, as we've discussed so many times, the benefits, the huge safety benefits of the self-driving car. And
right,
to the point we've even talked about, even if they kill a lot of people, you probably come out ahead, because humans kill so many people, right? But there's a potential risk associated with people becoming dependent on that technology. Tell us a little bit about that. Let's refresh our memories on that discussion from last week.
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about the uncanny valley and thing, and usually it's made in reference to, like, you know, maybe digital images of people or something like that, you know, and if something's really good, it's said to, as far as a digital image, it's said to cross the uncanny valley, right?
Right.
You know, so you begin to see digital actors, for example, in the new Fast and Furious movie, Paul, I forget the actor's name, I've got a mental block, but he passed away, like, less than halfway through filming that movie. And so what did they do? They used his brothers. He had two brothers. He has two brothers that served as stand-ins, and they also used digital imaging. And from what I've seen, it's pretty good. They did such a good job that, you know, you might think, wow, he was there for the whole movie, but he wasn't. And so what is my point with making that analogy? Well, the analogy is this. There is an uncanny valley with drivers, too. So if you have an artificial driver for a car or an airplane in this case, you know, you could say, well, you know what, at the very beginning of developing this, there's a long way to go. There's lots of decisions that these systems can't make, you know, they can't anticipate the way an experienced human driver would. And so, you know, would turning over the car or the airplane to a system like that be a good thing necessarily? Well, you know, it might actually be be worse than having a human in the loop, because the human could, you know, if he takes his attention off of the road, you know, in reliance on a system that's not very good, then the chances of an accident actually go up. Obviously, if a system is so good it's crossed the uncanny valley, then you probably got something that's better than human, because it never blinks, it looks in all directions, you got something better than a human driver. But I guess the point we make is, well, at what point do we get across the uncanny valley, Phil? And we're not there yet at all, at least not with cars. Did I answer the question, though? I mean, am I getting to what you were trying to get at on that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that's really the crux. By the way, it's Paul Walker. Was in
Thank you.
Fast and Furious. The question is, are we making, when we automate a process like this, are we making it safer? Or are we, through the law of unintended consequences, one of our favorite bugaboos to talk about on this show, are we actually making it worse, right? Are we inadvertently causing more damage, right? And here's the problem. You've got systems that approach people being able to, you know, look ma, no hands, right? Close their eyes, blah, 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 you know, pay no attention to driving. But they're not there yet. So in that instance, the risk is that people will lag in their attention, because the whole process is pretty boring anyway. They won't be bringing their A game to driving. And when they're needed to kick in, they just won't. They won't kick in the way they're supposed to, either because they won't be paying attention, or because, you know, they're totally disengaged from the experience of driving. Now, you know,
which is the big problem with talking on your cell phone anyway. I mean,
right.
You know, you could be looking at the road and have the cell phone to your ear. If your brain is otherwise engaged other than driving, that's the real problem with that sort of activity. You're still looking at the road, you still got your hand on the wheel, but you're not, you know, you're not 100% in the moment, you know. And you imagine how much worse it would be if the car is actually doing all the work. And
right.
And so yeah, that's and so there's questions about things like that. Now, I don't know, Phil, had you heard about Ford is going to be offering a system first in Europe. But hopefully, you know, the United States at some point, that allows you when this system is engaged. The whole point of this system is just to keep you from speeding.
Right.
You know, inadvertently. You know, I mean, I suppose you could turn it off and speed all you like. But, you know, if you start getting up above the speed limit by, you know, the set amount, you can set it at 5 miles per hour over or whatever. And if you get above that, it'll just, you know, it won't do it. It'll just stop at that speed and keep you from speeding any faster. Now, that's not, you know, that is sort of an autonomous thing. It's taking control of one aspect of driving, but it's not taking over so much that it takes you out of the loop, you know.
Right.
And so it seems to me that something like that actually makes driving safer. You know, if you choose to engage it.
To me, it would make, you know, it cuts the risk of getting a ticket. I would actually love to have that feature, because I'm a very goal-oriented driver. okay? And I have this problem of leaving just enough time to get someplace, and then sometimes just enough isn't quite enough. I had that experience today, actually. I was trying to drive from down here in the suburbs up into Denver, had a meeting at 1 o'clock, and didn't give myself quite enough time to do it. And so I'm driving along this street where I know the speed limit is 30, and I'm looking down, and it's like, 47. Okay, well, you know, it's pretty close.
30, 47, whatever. Yeah.
You know, it's ballpark, right? It's under 50.
Yeah.
So I would there's a lot of these features, you hear them as individual features, and you go, I would benefit from that, you know, the automatic parallel parking thing. Because sometimes I have to do a couple of takes before I get a parallel parking ride. It'd be nice just to have it one try and, you know, not have to worry about it. I think a lot of people get stage fright around parallel parking, right, which is why that one works. And then some of them, if you're just driving, right, if you're not, you have no thought that the car is doing the driving for you, but you're the one who's driving, but it's doing things like warning you of an imminent collision, right? You know, braking when you know you're about to hit something. You know, those kinds of things. I think people can immediately see those as, well, that's gonna be a net benefit, right? I mean, if people have a feature like that, without their, all things being equal, right, without their driving behavior otherwise being affected, then that's good, right? Because for those instances when they're when they weren't paying attention, or you know, they're supposedly engaged, but they're not. You know, I guess they're on their phone or whatever. That's really going to help. But as I look at it, I was thinking about this after we talked about it last week, and then this this plane crash really brought this question back to my mind. How easy or how hard is it really for us to make an assessment of what that risk is? Because you know what I'm hearing in the Uncanny Valley argument is, well, it's a new risk, right? This is a new problem that we didn't have before, right? We've got all the existing safety problems that exist with drivers, and no one knows, like you, Stephen, a person in your line of work, what those are, right? It's an extensive list of things that can go wrong,
right?
And this is a brand new one. I used to be a good driver, but now I'm disengaged because my car does most of the driving, and I'm bored and blammo, now I've had a terrible wreck. That's a new risk. But what we don't know is to what extent is that new risk offset by the fact that all these features that are making people less skilled drivers are also going to be preventing a lot of accidents, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, well, it's true that we would have net new accidents because people were less engaged, but we'd also have a lot less because those things are going to be preventing those from happening. And who knows what the math is, because we're talking scenarios here, right? There's no numbers to crunch necessarily. There's going to have to be a lot of testing and modeling done. But if it nets out kind of as we've said all along around self-driving cars, if it nets out that an almost self-driving car causes, you know, something horrible like 5,000 new fatalities every year because people aren't paying attention, but those features save 7,000 fatalities, right?
That would have happened otherwise.
Yeah, it would have happened otherwise. You know, and it's hard to know how we would ever make those determinations for sure. But if you had those numbers ahead of you, what would you say? You'd say, well, you know what? I hate it that 5,000 people died, but it's better than 7,000, right? 2,000 net lives are saved in the process. Is that just too calculating? Or?
No, I think it comes down to, there's, you know, in law, there's a thing called the reasonable man theory. And sort of sexist, but, you know, it's a product of its time.
We'll call it the reasonable person.
It's the reasonable person theory, okay? And in this case, maybe a reasonable driver is what you're looking at. And so, you know, they don't ask a judge sitting on the stand, doesn't ask that a person be a superhuman and to be able to stop their vehicle on a dime faster than it's designed to do, be perfect in every way. They you know, you need to be reasonably engaged when you're on the roadway. You need to be, you know, reasonably sober, and that means less than, I have a blood alcohol level of less than 0.08, right?
Right.
And, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be 0.00, but it better be less than 0.08. And you know, that's the sort of thing a judge would demand of a driver. Well, I think you know, of a system that is 100% in charge of the car. You know, hands off, you know, take me home, James, system. I think a judge sitting on the stand would demand that it be at least as good as the reasonable, you know, as the reasonable person standard,
right,
the reasonable driver.
Right.
And if it's not, then it doesn't pass muster. And, you know, I tag the auto companies for all these accidents. You know, you cause a fatality, guess what? You're writing a big old check. And you're going to keep writing these big old checks until you guys either take this off the market or make it better than what it is. And that's the way I think a judge would handle a situation like this. Now, I think that it's not going to be, you know, today we've got something that's perfect and, you know, and today we don't have anything and tomorrow we got a perfect system. I think that what will happen with autonomous driving is there's going to be these little things that are added onto our cars, you know, you know, like the speeding system, the anti-speeding system, the, you know, parallel parking, which by the way, are so good that, you know, the people that use them often will say, you know what, the car indicates that it could be parked in that spot, but I don't want it to because I'll never be able to get out. It's, you know.
No, it can't reverse parallel park, huh?
It can't reverse parallel park, you know. And
it can only get you in there. Oh, that's funny.
It can get you in there, and it's, you know, you got inches to spare. I'll never be able to get out. The,
right,
you know,
right.
The car says that's okay, but I say, no, it's not. I'm going to the next spot and let
right.
it park. So that's, you know, so you know, we'll get a lot of these little systems along the way until, you know, somebody says, you know what, we got a hands-off system now. And that's on down the road. And
yeah.
But I think until then, all these systems will be careful to come with lots of disclaimers saying this, you know, you are still the driver. You are responsible. You know, this is just to aid you, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And,
right.
And will not hold themselves out to be, you know, full-fledged autopilot systems. But this is, I guess this is a little, this discussion is a little bit removed from the German wings.
Well, we're
tragedy.
Almost there. We're almost there. I
okay.
wanted to establish that because you hit the exact right note, which is the reasonable driver standard. That's the standard against which these things ultimately have to be judged. Ultimately, you got to look at it and say, well, is this, you know, it's not, the problem is when you talk about this, the standard against which people tend to judge things is perfection. They say, well, that thing's going to crash sometimes, and that's unacceptable because someone will die. And the truth is, well, when you got human drivers, they're going to crash sometimes and people will die. So you actually have to do the math and say which one is less likely, which one is more likely. The standard
right.
shouldn't be perfection because perfection doesn't currently exist. The standard should be what people are doing now and what they're likely to be doing in the near future. That's the standard that the autonomous car has to be judged against. And that's my point, is that's the same standard that we should apply to any autonomous system we put in place for aircraft. Now, we've talked about this before. A lot of commercial aviation is autonomous now, anyhow.
Right.
With,
for years it has been.
Yeah, for years it has been. With in some ways, it's an easier problem to solve than car traffic because, you know, there's the lanes are a lot wider. Put it that way. You know, you're not encountering nearly as many other vehicles. It's in a lot of ways.
You know,
it's a go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, with commercial aviation particularly, it's you know, these pilots are almost more like systems monitors. You know, they just maybe the only time they touch the yoke is to flare right before landing. I mean, these
right.
you know, the rest of the time they're just kind of monitoring the system, making sure that it it does what it's supposed to do. But pretty much the rest of the time you're on autopilot. And
right,
they are incredible systems, and getting more and more sophisticated all the time.
So when I look at what happened in Germany, you know, there's two possibilities that come to mind that would have fixed that or prevented that from happening. I mean, speaking in terms of autonomous. Obviously, there's all kinds of security discussion we could have around this, but our topic is our topic here is self-flying planes at this point. So, you know, what are the two things that could have prevented that from happening? One is if there's just some way for the ground to take control of the plane, right?
Yeah.
If if and we know that and, that is possible because we got drones flying all over the place, right? We got the we got the U.S. intelligence agencies.
Yeah, we're getting more and more sophisticated with those drones too. We get more and more airtime with them. So, you know what? I love that idea.
Yeah, you know, there should be a way where, using narrow AI, using artificial intelligence, if no other indicators are telling you, to say, you know what, there's something really funky about this plane, and we're just going to take over right now.
After 9/11, they put locks on the cabin doors, which unfortunately worked against
the pilot, the enabler of the tragedy here.
But the ultimate lock door would be, the bad guys may be in the cockpit, but we got the plane, and you can't threaten me from 1,000 miles away. You know, I've got control of the aircraft right here, that's the ultimate taking the, there's no possibility for hijacking at that point, not really. Besides the fact that they would still have, human hostages. Beyond that fact, you wouldn't have control of the plane to do things like crash it into buildings or things like that. So, or take the plane down and kill everybody.
Well, I think that that method would work either as an emergency intervention, or we could just start flying planes that way, right? I mean, ultimately, you could. They fly that way. They fly that way anyway. Or the alternative is that capability is just built right into the plane. Because when you think about it, the idea of the idea of there being smart sensors on board a plane that are saying things like, an alarm goes off and a light flashes and says you're about to hit terrain, right? In some sense, the plane has enough sensors and intelligence to know that scenario is not right. Why not just have the plane take over at that point, right? If you're in an extreme situation, you're going 430 miles an hour and you're just over terrain, right? There's an excellent chance. Well, there's unfortunately a very strong chance that things aren't going to work out well anyhow. Why not just have the plane just try to, on its own, just take over and go back where it needs to go? I mean, I know that systems sophisticated enough to make something like that happen exist. Now, there's potential downsides with unintended consequences where a plane becomes less responsive and you can't get it to do certain things. If you overtune a system like that, it becomes hard to work with. But there's no reason in the world why a plane should ever be, in a nosedive heading straight to the ground at, 700 miles an hour, right? I mean, you think of the Egypt Air, right, where the plane was just put straight into a nosedive, straight down toward the Atlantic. Why not just have the planes be able to detect that and say, no, this isn't right, and I'm taking over? Between that and having a backup on the ground that could do it. It seems to me that you remove the threat of malfeasance, at least on the part of humans in the loop. You don't fix all the dumb things that somebody can do. Although some of them you do. I remember there was a crash back in the 90s where the air traffic controller was telling. I think it was in Indonesia. Air traffic controller was telling the pilot to turn left, and he meant right, and it just sent him right into a mountain, that kind of stuff. Even if, and the pilot wasn't quite sure, he's like, are you sure? And he's like, yeah, he's telling, go ahead and do it. The plane's just like, no, there's a mountain, I'm not going to, It's the equivalent of those collision prevention systems on cars, right? But it would be more sophisticated, and it would just at least correct the situation long enough maybe for a second line of defense to step in. And then that might be having people on the ground take control of the plane.
I love it. And I think, and quite frankly, Phil, I think that the technology is there. It's just a matter of implementing it. And I'm going to tell you, there's a lot of, there might even be some political aspects that would have to be overcome, maybe pilots unions, and maybe, and then of course, you know, do people feel safe with the idea that a plane could be taken over remotely? I mean, you'd have to convince people that there, you know, such a system is not prone to hacking. You know, that's you know, there are concerns that such a system would raise, but I'm going to tell you that when you see things like this this latest crash, it really brings home the need for such a thing. And you know, even the plane that flew out of Malaysia and went missing, you know, I mean, things like that. I mean, you could if you had a system that was, you know, keeping in contact with these aircrafts at all times, and then if it, you know, wandered off course too much, it would just, you know what, I'm bringing it back in on course and alerting the ground to perhaps take over the aircraft.
Well, and that's a good example. I mean, if you look at one of the most cited scenarios for what may have happened there is the plane immediately detects when it's depressurized, and it goes down to a much lower altitude for one thing to see if it, you know, save the lives of the people on board. But yeah, it doesn't then just keep flying straight in one direction. It sets out a beacon and it, you know, it says, "I'm here. Somebody take control." Right? I mean, I guess is basically what the message would be. But yeah, situations like that, depending on what happened, and I guess, you know,
and
we'll never know.
You know, and such a system could be programmed to, okay, go to a low altitude, go to a low enough speed so that you're not, you know, killing the passengers that have, you know, and turn towards the nearest commercial airport,
right.
and alert the ground to perhaps take over. You know, a system could be designed to do all those things. And
I think those are the things that have to be put in place ahead of ultimately the fully pilotless airplane, because
right.
if you have a completely autonomous plane or one that is largely autonomous and maybe receives some instructions from the ground, if there's no controls on the plane, right, there's no error, there's no possibility of anybody on the plane causing any damage, pilot or otherwise, right? That's the, you know, that's the goal. And it's not to suggest that pilots are a bad thing or to be overly critical of them. But if you look at the statistics around what causes airplane crashes, I mean, I looked this up today. I was thinking about this and I got interested in it. The percentage of crashes that are caused by pilot error are between 50% and 60%. It gives it by decade, and I think overall in all of history it averages out to about 53%. Then there's another 10% of human error that's not the pilot. So somebody else does something, like that air traffic control guy given the wrong direction, and things like that that cause the issues. And then there's instances of sabotage and criminal activity, which is another 10%. So you look at the mechanical failure side of airplane crashes, it's roughly 30-35% when it's because the machine broke down. The rest of the time, 60-65%, it's because a person did something wrong, either deliberately, not most of the time, or accidentally, most of the time, is what occurs. So if you can, you know, the mechanical and electronic systems we have currently, in a sense, are doing better than the humans already. And if you give them a harder job to do, to your point, Stephen, I think, you know, we've got the capability, we've got the technology to make something like that happen. I think it's past time we started moving seriously in that direction.
We have the technology. We can make them better, stronger, faster, right?
There you go. Exactly. And I think we need to. I think, you know, there's good business for the airlines in that. It's an opportunity space for people who design these kinds of systems, and it's just the right thing to do. I mean, it's the thing to make the experience even safer. Air travel, is statistically, as we all know, it's the safest way to travel, and it's gotten safer and safer. We're kind of on almost a Moore's law of air safety, and to continue it, I think, you know, these are the kind of next steps that we're going to have to take. So I am optimistic that we'll see some of those kinds of changes implemented in the coming years, especially as we get more familiar with the idea of the self-driving car. I think that might help kind of push people along, and we see more and more drone activity. We're going to get used to the idea that that machines are pretty good at doing these things.
Absolutely. Okay.
All right. Well, not to change the subject, but let's talk about something else. What do you say? That's
something a little more upbeat. That one's kind of a downer topic.
Let's bring it up a notch. How about this?
Downer.
Unless you got one, I've got one.
Go for it.
Because we're doing catch up from last week. We carried over a conversation from last week, and I want to talk about a big event that we missed last week, which was the 50th anniversary of the first spacewalk. Alexei Leonov walked in space, first EVA ever, March 18th, 1965. So March 18th, what was that? Almost over a week ago, 8 days ago, Wednesday, was the 50th anniversary of the first ever spacewalk. And that's quite a milestone. It always shocks me when I hear of things in space hitting their 50th anniversary. We're not far from the 50th anniversary of Apollo now, which is going to seem very strange to me, because, you know, that stuff should be the modern future stuff that's happening. And here it is now, you know, 50 years in the past, that an astronaut, actually in this case a cosmonaut, ever first ventured out of a capsule on a tether and walked around in space. Mostly he floated around. If you've ever seen the videos of these early spacewalks, it really was just a matter of pretty much, okay, I'm hooked to a rope and the rope's hooked to the capsule and now I'm dangling out here in orbit. But a huge milestone.
I've gone from floating inside the capsule to floating outside the capsule. To me, spacewalking really got real when they fixed the Hubble.
Yeah.
That was when they started doing real work in space. That's when spacewalking got real, and involved coming up with techniques. How do you brace yourself in order to break loose a bolt? All sorts of considerations that you don't have to think about when you have gravity applied to you. But up in space, you do have to think about it.
You've got advantages, which is that you don't weigh anything. So it's like, well, it's easy to move yourself. It's easy to move equipment around and things like that. But you're in this bulky, pressurized suit. You can't turn your head very well. I mean, there's just a lot of things that you normally expect to be able to do when you're moving that you can't do.
Turn the bolt, instead I turn myself.
How are you going to get the torque that you need, right?
Yeah.
And anything you set down is just going to float away. That's a problem too.
That's
that you don't normally encounter. And in fact,
Velcro is your friend.
There you go. That's why it was invented. Leonov encountered that himself. There was as originally reported, obviously in Pravda back in '65. This was a huge success, a glowing success, and everything went wonderfully well. Now, many years later, Leonov tells the story. Apparently, something went wrong with his suit, and it puffed up like a balloon, and his fingers just turned into these like huge sausages. And I guess his limbs, everything. He was just kind of a Michelin man out there, to the point where he lacked the mobility that he needed to rewind the tether. It appeared that he was not going to be able to get himself back into the capsule for a few minutes there. And then he figured out he just depressurized himself. He's like, well, I've got to let a lot of the pressure out. Hopefully I won't let out so much that it kills me, but I'm going to let out enough so
I black out and that would kill me. Yeah,
exactly.
He was alone, wasn't he? He didn't have another person to pull him in.
Yeah, he was by himself. So there's a system with no backups and no, if you black out up there, no one's going to turn the air back on for you, Alexei. You're done. So,
a brave guy. Just a brave guy.
Yeah, just like one of the American pilots in the right stuff or any of our astronauts. I mean, he's just, I better turn my pressure down low enough so I can work this thing. And when you hear him tell the story, it's like, well, that was kind of interesting. But, boy, the view. Oh, to see that view of the Earth. To him, the headline is not so much, I almost died. To him, the headline was, man, that was quite a view of the Earth while I was having that spacewalk. So,
the guys that get to go up there, it's like, they're never quite the same. They always dream of going back. John Glenn, he's a retired senator sitting at the House, and they ask him, you want to go up? Absolutely. And he gets on the space shuttle, You know, the sucker's 80 years old.
I'm sure if Buzz Aldrin was given the opportunity, he'd go today.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
At his age.
Buzz, we need an old guy to go to Mars, and it's got to be a one-way trip, so we're taking old people. What do you say? You know, he'd start doing push-ups and whatever he needed to get in shape to do it.
I'm sure he's still doing them.
Absolutely.
All right, so that's the 50th anniversary of the spacewalk, a great milestone and something we missed last week. And what else we got to talk about tonight, Stephen?
Well, this is kind of an interesting thing. These color lenses that allow people that are colorblind. Phil, did you get to see the video that was associated with it? It's a paint company that's sponsoring this. The paint company Valspar, but the actual name of the lenses is Enchroma. Enchroma is the name of the company that are making these glasses, or they look more like shades for people who are colorblind. And Phil, this is exciting to me personally.
I did see the video. Let me tell you, and it's interesting. They're cool looking glasses. They do look like they'd make the world a little bit darker, but my first reaction to that video is, I don't know if people who make these kinds of videos are just getting better at manipulating me, but I was amazed by how moved I was by that video. You got people who are colorblind. I mean, colorblind is not an affliction you think about that often.
It's not something that, you know, really affects people in the way that, you know, like actual blindness would affect them, or deafness or something like that. It's, you know, a person could be 100% colorblind and see the world like a black and white TV set.
Right.
For you kids, you know, under the age of 30, there used to be televisions that had no color at all. But anyway, so that's the way they would. That's
weird.
The way people like that. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's why people like that experience life have true 100% colorblindness. But you can live a 100% full life, you know, you get married, have kids, hold down a job all your life and never have, you know, never look back and never really miss it. Until you like put on some of these lenses, perhaps.
That's it exactly, Stephen. When you think about color blindness, you think, well, you know what? It's the experience of color is purely subjective and these people don't know what they're missing.
Right.
And what you see in this video is people discovering for the first time what they've been missing. And that is just astounding to watch. This moment
of
what everybody was talking about all this time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you know, you see this old guy. I mean, you know, he's at least in his 70s, maybe his late 70s, putting on those glasses and seeing and going, oh, wow. You know, and they have these threads set up in the video that show the whole color spectrum, and so it allows you to see, oh, there was a color here between here and here, and I never got it before, and I'm seeing it now, and that to me is remarkable. And quite frankly, Phil, I'm considering purchasing a pair of these glasses. I've known for years that I have blue-green color blindness. And, you know, it's not one of those things that you really ever think about. And, you know, it was not much of an issue until I learned about it when I was, I think I was a seventh grader or something. Just for science class, they did, like, colorblindness tests. And about three or four people in the class turned out to have some level of colorblindness. And I was one of them.
Huh.
And so, you know, I had everybody in class, well, what's that like? What's it like? Well, I don't know. I've never looked through any other eyes than me. You know, I can't tell you what I'm experiencing or what I'm not experiencing.
Right.
And, you know, when you look at the sky, what color does it look like? Well, I suppose I'm seeing blue, you know.
Exactly.
That's the color everybody.
So that's interesting, Stephen. So when you watch this video, when any of us watch, one of the things that's really cool about this video is that it's in color, but it starts out in this very muted palette. I don't know if you noticed that, but everything that we're, you know, this discussions with these people, it's almost black and white, but not quite, but almost black and white. And then when they put the glasses on and we start seeing colors as they're seeing them for the first time, you know, it's kind of the Wizard of Oz, right? Where you have, it's not quite that stark, but almost that stark of a contrast between the two things that are taking place there. So in fact, Stephen, when you watch this video, it impacted you, but you know that maybe you didn't get the full effect, right?
Exactly. It's sort of like seeing a advertisement for an HDTV on your standard television. You know what I mean?
Right.
How do I get the real effect of how great this is? Anyway, so I went to the website for Enchroma, followed the links from the Valspar video there to Enchroma. And they've got a colorblindness test, and I took the colorblindness test again, and no surprise, I'm still colorblind. And it says here after, I mean, it took quite some time. I was worried that I wouldn't have time to finish it before the show. It took about 12, 13 minutes, and it says mild deuteral anomaly. And based on customer feedback from people with similar results to you, we believe there's a 95% chance that Enchroma glasses will help your color vision. And you have there's a 30-day guarantee. You can return it, return the glasses, no problem within 30 days. And it looks like about the cheapest pair of these glasses that I could purchase is $350. And I'm considering it. I really am. We might have to do a sequel to this segment later on after I've had a chance to try these out.
Well, definitely we will have to revisit this. If you get some, we want to talk about this because you're in a privileged position here, Steve. And I know it's an odd thing to say because as far as I know, I'm not colorblind. I need to take the test too because I guess you wouldn't know unless you were told you are. But I see green and blue and, all these things. But presumably you always thought you did too, right? I mean.
Yeah. What I see it, this is green, this is blue. And sometimes I'd be wrong. And they'd say, no, that doesn't really match. And my wife will pat me on the arm. You're doing it again. You're wearing something that completely clashes. Oh, I'm sorry. Here, wear this instead. And I said, okay, that also looks good to me.
I just thought that was a guy thing. That's a colorblind thing.
Well, it's sort of a guy thing in the sense that maybe men don't care as much about things like that. But I have in addition to the guy thing, I also have the I can't see certain shades of blue and green. They blend together more than the average person. So anyway, it's interesting. The miracle is that there's not more a variation in how we perceive color than there is. Color vision, according to some scientists, was developed, the reason we can see in color and perhaps, things like a dog, they cannot, is because dogs eat meat. They don't need to see color to eat meat. We eat, in addition to meat, we eat fruit that we need to know when it's in season.
Right.
And if you're good at picking that out, then you're less likely to starve. And so that's the whole basis for our color vision. And it's so well developed that there's not a whole lot of variation among humans as to how we perceive color, apparently. And so that to me is pretty interesting. So
that is really interesting. Well, I mean, we should talk a little bit about this is addressed in the video when they say that color blindness is not something that goes on in people's brains. It's something that goes on in their eyes, and it's reasonably easy to correct for it. I mean, the idea that they can just make lenses that fix this is pretty astounding because, I mean, this is new.
I would have thought the problem was between my eyes and my brain. I didn't think it was, something that you could fix with a lens because I figured it was a problem with the communication between the two. But it speaks to
eventually there being contacts or some kind of LASIK or something like that that will just correct this. I would think if they can overlay it with a lens, eventually they can fix this. What I was going to say is, this is a unique position to be in, because here you are as an adult getting to see colors you've never gotten to see before. That's a unique experience to get to look forward to, actually. Those of us who have been seeing them all our lives can never appreciate them the same way that, like, you or somebody in those in the videos can. So we definitely want to hear about this, Stephen. If you decide to go ahead and make the purchase and get these, we want to hear about it. In fact, we should probably do a show about that, about seeing colors for the first time, because, you know, it speaks to kind of a futuristic, kind of a transhuman idea, doesn't it? The idea of improving our senses and perceiving things that we haven't before. Now, there are, you know, if you have the full range of vision, it's not like there's new primary colors that any of us will ever get to see, right? The colors that exist are the ones that exist. But we can all look forward potentially to one day being able to discern them better, right? To be able to focus
right.
better, to be able to see in the dark. I mean, there's a lot of potential improvements that or enhancements that can be added to vision that might make the experience even more profound than it already is. Although it's not to spoil the video, but one of the great moments is they're just having this wonderful sunset as these people walk out of this gallery where they've been looking at colors, and the sky is just lit up red, and the guy's got the glasses on. And he's looking at it, and he says? So this is what you guys have been seeing all this time, right?
yeah.
You know, the idea that there's this layer of reality that we're not yet perceiving that can be opened up to us is a very exciting idea, you know?
What was interesting to me, also quite moving, was the father looking at his son's, you know, drawings that he had made with crayons, you know?
Right.
He said, you know, I kind of had wondered why there were so many crayons in the box, you know.
Yeah.
And he sees it. You know, I see he sees what his son was doing with those crayons. That, you know, and that was quite remarkable to be able to appreciate his own son's, you know, art much better than he could have otherwise. And that's kind of a beautiful thing. I love that.
You know, I write these possibilities every day. I write the 500-word descriptions of a possible world-transforming change. And one I wrote a while back, some of them are a little bit out there, but an idea that occurred to me was, what if you had a box of crayons that had 16 million crayons in it, right? What if it had a crayon for every color, every possible color in the whole RGB scale, like from the old RGB standard for monitors? They're well past 16 million colors now. You know, you can do, you know, I don't know, 120 million or whatever it is today. But even if it was just 16 million, okay, that would be an impressively huge box of crayons. I guess you would need a house or bigger to hold your box of crayons. But Not just the fact that something like that could be made, which would be very cool. I mean, I'd like to see that, you know, if not own it. But to have vision sophisticated enough that would really make a difference, right? that you could be scrolling through the 150,000 shades of violet to find
difference in each one. You know, it would be something akin to perfect pitch in hearing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, perfect color perception to be able to pick that out. And there, you know, there are people that, and I would guess that most of them are women, who can differentiate shades that are, you know, just so similar. And in my eyes, they're not, you know, there's no difference between this shade and that shade. And my wife will tell me there's a huge difference between that shade and that shade. I can't believe you can't see that. I would love to be able to see that and have the perfect pitch hearing too, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's all good. let's get the full package. I think that's what we're all about here, right? The world transformed is. We want the full experience. Okay, we just got a few minutes left. And there's definitely one more that I want to that I want to hit on this evening, because we started out on a negative note, and because we started out talking about getting humans out of the loop Let's talk a little bit about a human that we're really glad was in the loop. And a great piece over on Don Serber's blog. The piece is called Norman Borlaug, He Saved a Billion Lives. And this is the story of one of the great human beings of all time. Is there any other way to describe this kind of unassuming man who did, you know, important work, but certainly not glamorous work, who worked internationally, but not on the world stage the way we think of it. And in a century when people were trying to outdo themselves in terms of being obsessive and evil and violent, he figured out a way to feed people. And the estimate that he saved a billion lives is probably on the low side, isn't it?
Yeah. And because he started a revolution they call the Green Revolution that is allowing the world to feed itself. And it's a simple thing. It's amazingly simple thing. He started with normal wheat and worked with this normal wheat with a full size stalk to create a dwarf wheat that has a head on it with the same amount of food, but a stalk that's like what, 6-8 inches tall,
right?
Much lower to the ground, and so the plant spends less energy, less time growing the stalk, and more growing the food. And so you get the same amount of food with less growing time. And guess what? When it's less growing time, you might have, in some places, you might have a chance to grow more than one crop in a single growing season.
Right.
But you might. There's also this aspect. If the wheat is in the field for a lesser amount of time, then there's less risk of it being destroyed by fire or by locusts or by, you know, hailstorms or whatever it is that could destroy a crop.
It's easier on the soil.
You're
not depleting the soil nearly as much as you would really kind of wasting it on that stalk, right, which wasn't doing anybody any good anyhow.
Yeah, it's a remarkable human being who did as much to, who saved the world in a way. There's only one other person that I would even compare in the 20th century to him as far as the number of lives saved. Can you hazard a guess as to who I'm thinking of?
Let me see. It's going to be someone who did something around sanitation, I'm sure. Is that right?
No. This
is still nutrition.
Let me give you a big hint.
Okay.
He was a citizen of the Soviet Union.
I'm still not. You know what? I'm drawing a blank. Who are we talking about?
Okay. Stanislav Petrov. He saved the world by not pushing the button, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah, his systems told him that the U.S. had done a preemptive launch of our missiles, and he refused the order to respond, and said,
absolutely.
"Let's wait."
We've talked about him before, and I'm embarrassed that I didn't remember his name. These are names we should know, aren't they?
Yes.
And
by and large, the world does not know these people.
Right.
Norm Borlaug. Borlaug? Is that how you pronounce him?
Borlaug is how I would pronounce that, yes.
Borlaug. Norm Borlaug and Stanislav Petrov. Great men who did their part to save the world.
That's a nice note to end on. I did want to point out that a lot of what Borlaug did is being carried on today in GMO research, which is highly controversial. I think mostly needlessly controversial. But efforts around making food more nutritious, helping to prevent diseases, helping to make it more pest resistant, all that kind of work kind of hails back to the work that he did originally. I know there are people who were highly suspicious of GMOs, but if you follow the link and read what Borlaug was doing, I think you start to see that what people are trying to do today is not really all that different. They're trying to make the same kinds of changes occur, and for the same kinds of reasons, to help people live longer, right? To feed people and to keep them healthy. Those are really good goals to be working on, and don't know. That's a great story to end with. All right, what's our music tonight?
Well, we got a fun one tonight. This one is "Bad to the Bone" by the Autopilot Club.
Oh, very good, Stephen. Once again, topical show with a topical song. "Bad to the Bone" by the Autopilot Club. Well, thank you, Stephen, for putting that together for us. Thank you all for being with us. We'll be back again next week with another brand new show. And until next time, live to see it.